Hi, I'm Femi OK. Today on the stream, three stories in one episode. The run-up to the Kenyan presidential election is nearing its final lap, and we're checking in on the last campaigning push. In Egypt, Alaa Abdel El Fattah has spent the best part of two decades in prison. We'll speak about the efforts being made to free him. But first, we start in Ukraine, where it has been almost 150 days since the war began. Fighting rages in the east, peace talks continue to hit hurdles, and the global grain shortage caused by the war continues. But it's civilians who are paying the highest price. Here's Joe English from UNICEF.
The situation for children and families affected by the conflict in Ukraine continues to be desperate, you know, and children are paying a horrific price for the fighting. Almost 350 children have now lost their lives. Almost 550 have been injured in the fighting. And these are just the numbers that the UN has been able to verify. So we know the true toll is likely to be far higher. And whilst the fighting has been concentrated in the east for much of the last few weeks, just this week we saw an attack in the centre of the country take the life of a four-year-old. So truly, it feels like nowhere is safe for children, for families in Ukraine at the moment. And so we continue to call for a ceasefire because ultimately, you know, until that happens, we will continue to see children lose their lives day after day.
Last week, the International Criminal Court called for an overarching strategy to bring perpetrators of war crimes in Ukraine to justice. And representatives from dozens of countries have pledged to cooperate. And as the global food crisis continues, officials from Russia and Ukraine are expected to discuss resuming Kyiv's exports. Dozens of ships are stranded and 20 million tonnes of grain are stuck. So much to discuss. With us, we have Katerina Molofieva. She is a journalist in Kyiv. Katerina, thank you so much for joining us. Joe English there was saying nowhere is safe. As a journalist, how would you report that story, that sense that Ukraine is under attack and has been under attack for 150 days?
Well, I agree with him. First and foremost, I'm not a journalist. I'm a human being, and I'm also scared of the ongoing war because I've been covering the war in Ukraine for the past 8 years, and I also covered another conflict. But sometimes, when I think about the horrors of the recent weeks, when residential areas were targeted by the cruise missiles or caliber launched from the ship. It is scary to get to sleep sometimes at night or wake up because you don't know. It feels unsafe everywhere in Ukraine. So you can't find a safe haven anywhere in Ukraine at the moment.
I want to bring in some voices of civilians who have been under attack, under one of the worst areas that have been attacked recently in Ukraine. Here are their voices. And then, Katerina, let's talk about the people who decided to stay in a conflict country. Hear the civilians first of all.
Children need to live their lives. The youths, 19, 20-year-olds, are made into cripples. They kill children, they take away our children. How is this possible? A woman has been killed. She ran out of the house when she was hit. Along with her husband, he was killed too. The man from the flat just there was killed too. Three people lost their lives. Why? What for? Because Putin went mad?
What kind of military objects are we talking about? Destroyed houses? Schools? Damaged kindergartens? Are these military objects? These are all civilian objects. Today, there are many families that lost roofs over their heads. They have no apartments, no houses. People have worked all their lives to create normal conditions to live in.
At the time I attended school, I was not a big fan of it. But now that I have seen what happened, I ask why. The kids, when the war is over, where are they going to learn?
Katerina, from your reporting, when you've been talking to civilians and telling the civilian story, what would you like to share with us?
Well, I speak to people in different areas of Ukraine, but I would like to stress on people who stay in Donbas, where the severe battles are ongoing right now. So people been split for the past 8 years. The families were split. And also, you know, when you talk to people about why they're staying put, why they're not leaving, quite often this is the situation connected to the financial financial situation and occasionally with political inclinations, because there is a number of people in Donbass who never felt a part of Ukraine, and all because of the language they speak, because of the Russian language. So I'm talking about the elderly people who are staying there. So unfortunately, this is the situation. We see a huge number of refugees, Ukrainian refugees in Europe, but even those, they're coming back to Ukraine because of the financial issues too, and they have to live under this, shelling and constant threat for their lives.
I want to go to YouTube because some of our viewers are wanting to talk to you and ask you questions. This one is from Unique Views, watching right now. Thank you. This war must stop. The wheat belongs to the world or the trading partners and not to a single country. For trade agreements, we need at least two parties. This wheat is urgently needed. What can you tell us about the grain, the wheat that has been trying to get out of Ukraine into the rest of the world? How is that going?
Well, actually, not two parties right now. Four parties have been involved in the discussions, and hopefully this week the negotiation will be signed. To name this party, there are Ukraine, Russia, Turkey, and the UN. Last week, there were discussions, talks about the decision has been made about the export of the wheat, of the grain that's stuck right now in Ukrainian storages. More than 22 million grain is stuck in Ukrainian storage and cannot be exported right now. So we hope that on the 20th or 21st, the agreement will be signed between these four parties. But the biggest problem is, of course, we understand that Ukraine is a world food basket, and Ukrainian port of Odessa is a gate of Ukrainian exports. Just to say that Ukraine, it is an agricultural country, and but we provide enough grain for the Ukrainian, for the local population. Who is suffering the most is the world. So, for example, if we produce annually 100 million tons of grain, Ukraine just needs 20 million of grain. So we produce four or five times more than we need.
Katerina, let me just bring in the European Union Foreign Policy Chief, Josep Borrell, who said this just a little bit earlier today. Let's have a listen.
The most worrisome thing is the lack of food in many countries around the world. And there is not food because Russia is blocking the export of Ukrainian grain. We are doing whatever we can in order to support this grain through other ways, through the solidarity lanes, through the Black Sea, through Romania, Bulgaria, but that's not enough. So I hope, and I think I have a hope, that this week it will be possible to reach an agreement to deblock Odessa and other Ukrainian ports.
Katerina, I'm going to share with you one more thought from YouTube. This one comes from Walter Hughes. Hello, Walter. Walter says it is already World War III. It's not just being waged on the battlefield, but all over the world. Almost every human is being affected by this war. That is how Walter describes it. As we wrap up our conversation today, Katerina, how would you describe the war in Ukraine?
It is scary, to put it in one word, because I've never seen anything like this before. We live in the situation of uncertainty. We are worried about our families. We are worried about the outcome of the war. We are deeply affected already. We have numerous of casualties among the civilian population and among the soldiers. The population is traumatized because we have to work. We have to. Everyone need to accelerate to basically to put an end to this war. But it is scary.
Scary. Thank you so much, Katerina, for sharing with us your reporting in Ukraine, and we appreciate you. We'll come back to you in the future. Now we head to Kenya, where some are skeptical that the upcoming presidential election will have any real sustainable change in the country.
As Kenya prepares for the next general election in August 9th, 2022, we see the rise of misinformation, disinformation, and fake news, especially on social media platforms sponsored by different political entities, a media that has been accused by different political quarters of being biased, and the rise of opinion polls that are trying to shape a political conversation on who is the most popular candidate and how Kenyans are likely to vote. Unfortunately, we're still struggling with the question of apathy, as most young people did not show up or turn out to register as voters, but also with the tough economic times that are making it hard for especially young people to be invested in the political conversations that are happening.
With us now, political commentator Patrick Gathara. Patrick, welcome back to the stream. We always love having you on. All right, so is Kenya having a voting fever, or is it more of a mild cold? Where are we with this election? What's the mood like?
I think the fever is definitely on now. Okay. It wasn't on a month ago. It took a while to sort of catch on, and I think this election has been different from previous ones in the sense that there hasn't been as much investment in participation in it, you know, especially amongst the youth. Lots of them were really being pushed to register, when in previous elections, you know, you'd have long queues, guys trying to get on etc. I think, though, in the last 1 month, we've seen much more engagement, especially after the running mates were picked out. So there's much more excitement now than there was before.
I want to play a little bit of Martha Karua. Before I do that, she is running as a VP. Before I do that, can you just set up who she is, what she stands for, before we hear from Martha herself?
Well, Martha Karua is running as, for the position of deputy. In the Azimio coalition under Raila Odinga. She has been sort of in the trenches for reform for a long time, somebody who's really well known for taking tough stances, has had a fair share of scandal and also of, I would say, disaffection or toleration, I would say, of bad behavior by politicians.
Okay.
So she's not exactly Mrs. Clean, you know, but I think she'd be called fairly the Iron Lady of Kenyan politics.
All right, I like the way that you're very cautiously approaching describing Martha Karua's background in politics. Let's hear from her herself.
Corruption is choking the nation. We need to release the resources available, both financial and otherwise, to meet the needs of the people.
I am wondering about other candidates. It looks like, Patrick, that there were some candidates who are running just on one issue. Not how do we improve Kenya, but how do we improve one thing about Kenya? That feels new to me. Is it new to you, Patrick?
It is new, and actually it is kind of encouraging to me, I've got to say. For a long time, our elections have been run essentially as ethnic census. You know, every guy tries to come to bring his sort of voting block of his tribe's mates or his ethnic mates who vote for him. But this election has been different. A lot of it has been actually argued on the basis of particular issues, you know. And even if you speak about kind of like the fringe candidate, somebody like Professor Ajakoya, who's made one of his planks the legalization of marijuana and the marijuana trade, you know. That's a great thing. I think it's good that people are actually talking about issues and are talking just about ethnicity. You know, you look at what William Ruto, who's standing against Raila, is doing. Also, he's made this campaign more about what he calls hustlers versus dynasties, you know. And that's great. You know, so the further we get away from this sort of identification with ethnic communities to actually discussing the problems that Kenyans have, for me, that would always be a good thing.
On YouTube, we have Nastia Adan. I hope as a Kenyan, this election won't repeat itself as it did in 2007. That's going way back. That's over a decade. That's a long time.
Yes, it is. And I think, I mean, there's always the question of whether there's going to be violence or not. To be honest, it is a fair question because we've never had elections that don't have at least some level of violence. But it does tend to vary. But I think this one is unlikely to have significant violence for the simple reason, if you look at history, most of our violence has happened when incumbents are running. So whether you're talking about 2007 when President Kibaki was running for re-election, you know, or 2017 when President Kenyatta was running for re-election, those have been fairly violent elections. But the ones in between that, when you don't have an incumbent running, have been remarkably less violent. So, and I think we're in that stage now. President Kenyatta is obviously retiring, so he's not going to be running again. Mm-hmm. And I think history is probably going to repeat itself. The second reason why I don't think there's going to be violence,
yes,
is actually we've come a long way in establishing institutions for dealing with electoral conflict.
Yeah.
In 2007, we really didn't have a court that anybody could trust, which is part of the reason why people thought this had to be settled out on the street. You know, but since 2013, 2017, we've seen court cases, the election being challenged at the Supreme Court. In 2017, it was actually annulled, you know, and I think that has actually sort of given lots of confidence to people that if there is a dispute, and I have no doubt that there will be a dispute after the election, if you look at what the campaigns are saying, they're already setting it up.
Okay, Patrick.
There's going to be a challenge.
Patrick, I love that we are ending on a positive note, which is not always the case when we talk to you on the stream. But I like that, and I think we should get out while you're still fairly optimistic. Patrick, thank you so much. Right. Appreciate you.
Thank you.
Now we go from Kenya to Egypt in the case of Alaa Abd El Fattah, who is one of thousands of political prisoners facing brutal conditions and overcrowded cells. Have a look at this clip from my colleagues at Listening Post.
Alaa Abd El Fattah is just one of an estimated 65,000 political prisoners in Egypt. Having spent most of the decade since the Arab Spring behind bars, he is now more than 3 months into a hunger strike that could take what is left of his life. His is a voice the Egyptian authorities clearly want
silenced.
Oh, Mona, that is heartbreaking to hear that from your brother. Like, we're not going to win. We may not win, but we still have to fight. Mona Saif is Alaa's sister. She joins us now live on the stream. And Hussein Bahami, who's Egypt and Libya researcher at Amnesty International. Thank you both for joining us. When you hear your brother, I know you've seen that before, that clip, Mona. When you hear him say that, does that really sum up your situation as a family member trying to get him out of prison in Egypt?
Yes, it does sum up the situation. And actually, the clip hit me a bit hard because when you know the context as well, it gives you a glimpse into our story as a family. This was in September 2014 when Alaa was briefly released from prison a month after my father passed away. And this was in a memorial service for my father, Ahmed Saif al-Islam, who was a human rights lawyer. And less than a month later, Alaa was back to prison again. So it was just a brief few weeks in which he was out and he had a chance to talk to the people and to share this particular statement, which is very powerful. And it's how we function. So we don't know if he'll ever be victorious. We don't know if he'll ever be able to, you know, stop human rights violations in Egypt and hold everyone who's committed them accountable to what they did. But we have to be constantly victorious, just to being right to the truth, doing our best to it.
Hussein, can you be super candid here about why is Alaa in a prison in Egypt right now? Why is he locked up?
Quite simply because Alaa is a prisoner of conscience. He is imprisoned quite simply because of his political beliefs. He is imprisoned because he dared to believe for a democratic Egypt. He's imprisoned because he has been the voice of someone that was that died, been tortured and died in prison before. This is not our assessment even. This is a court document that convicted him solely on the basis of tweets where he defended the right of a man that died in a prison, the same prison that he was initially imprisoned in.
Mona, what do you do when you're facing a force and a justice system like Egypt's, where so thousands of people are prisoners of conscience, they're political prisoners, they're opponents? How do you get your loved one out of that situation?
That's the thing, because it's not just Alaa, because it's thousands of people out there, thousands of people locked in Abdel Fattah Sisi's prisons in Egypt, you realize that your journey is a collective one, that you need to work on a more collective pressure and documenting and speaking up about what's happening in prisons, what's happening to thousands of political prisoners, and you need to make the everyone aware that Alaa is a litmus test. Alaa is a known activist. He has always been targeted by different Egyptian regimes. He has been in prison for the past, for the majority of the past 8 years, so since Abdel Fattah Sisi came to power. And the fact that he has been exposed to torture, the fact that he has been deprived of basic rights like newspapers, reading for more than 2 years, a lot of time correspondence with the family, time out, and even a fair trial. He has been sentenced in front of an emergency court. We didn't have a trial. We didn't have access to the files. So all of these things give you a glimpse into the reality of what other thousands of people are enduring in Egypt and their families. Because if this is happening to Alaa, who is a very well-known activist with that massive support and with a family vocal, then worse is happening to
us. Do you know what I'm wondering? I'm wondering what you tell your nephew, Alaa's little boy. He's 10, I believe. What are you telling your nephew about his dad?
It's very difficult. It's very difficult because Khaled just turned 10 last year. We don't understand how much he understands of the whole situation. We do know for sure that it hit him very hard when Alaa was released in March 2019. And Khaled was excitedly welcoming Alaa back into his life. And they were going to swimming lessons together and everything.
Yeah.
And then, you know, 6 months later, he got taken away from him, and he got thrown into the worst conditions ever. So the Alaa's conditions in prison are actually making us unable to take Khaled to visit him. So he hasn't seen Khaled for over a year now. So it's very tough. It's very tough to maintain this. And actually, I'm glad you asked me about that, because this is precisely what drove Alaa to start the hunger strike in April 2nd, because he was feeling like his boy is going to become a teenager soon and without his father. And he was just too fed up with, tolerating this kind of abuse and being deprived of his life.
Okay.
And so he went on hunger strike to put an end to this, to out and be a father to Khaled.
Let me just ask Hussein, we're at the very last moment of our show. Will a hunger strike push Egypt to release Alaa?
Look, it's very simple here. Like, Alaa's detention is in violation of international law. It even violates Egyptian law. Alaa should not be imprisoned, just like the tens of thousands of political prisoners in Egypt that are imprisoned simply for dreaming of a better Egypt. The President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi has the power to release Alaa Abdel Fattah by Egyptian law, by the law on state of emergency, under the constitution, with a simple pen.
Thank you, Hussein.
Stroke, so he should release him, and he must be released indeed. And
we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much. We do appreciate you joining us, and Mona as well. Thanks for watching, everybody. I'll see you next time.